Where are we at now?
Phil's Osophy, a hardbound collection of all the life lessons I've learned.
God is not a Gumby action figure that you can shape any way you want.
Phil, have you gone mental?
Act like men, not like girls.
I've got a real clear message for the two of you on that. Stop doing it.
How about we agree to argue until one of us actually refutes the other?
Are you kidding me?
It is time for Too Wretched for Radio with the one, with the only, the blindsider, Phil Johnson. Phil, the big conversation in the last few weeks has been your participation in the Shepherd's Q&A conference. Many things are being said on the internet. Let us hear from the horse's mouth what happened, and most importantly, where are we at in this complicated issue of social justice, which is where I want to start with you, Phil. I think that this has been a lesson in discernment, or at least it should be so far for us, because there are so many people that they've heard maybe somebody say one thing or share a platform with some person that they have an issue with regarding social justice, and it's just an immediate black and white judgment. That's it. No quarter. Division. And I think that this is an issue that should teach us all how to discern better, specifically regarding the issue of time, and that sometimes time is needed to bring final conclusion or clarity to the issue. So before we jump into the Shepherd's Q&A, how are we doing these days when it comes to the issue of discernment?
Yeah, you know, I mean, what you just said is what I said from the beginning about this issue. It's obviously a dangerous and explosive issue, and it is one that I think we need to take some time to sort out and think through before we start to anathematize one another. I still would make that plea today, even after the Shepherd's Conference Q&A, where I think what you see there is the volatility of this issue, number one, and the emotional punch it carries when men who aren't used to disagreeing with one another don't see eye to eye on this one. And it seems to me charity demands that we give a little bit of latitude in terms of time for some of the issues to sort themselves out.
And for people just to make themselves clear on their positions, which frankly they might actually be thinking through themselves. Phil, you tell me if you agree or disagree with this view, assessment, that many people saw the Dallas statement as being a statement of orthodoxy. Was that its intent?
Well, it wasn't my understanding of its intent. I thought it was an invitation to dialogue, and it sort of meant to put the issues on the table and say, look, we see these as matters that actually do potentially impinge on the gospel and historically have impinged on the gospel. When you begin to mix, you know, social issues with the gospel, you end up with a social gospel, and historically that has not been good. I don't think that the statement's intent was to say, okay, we're at the point now where we need to draw lines of separation, and if you don't sign this statement, we're not going to have fellowship with you. I don't think anybody who drafted the statement or signed it, at least none of the original signatories, had that idea in mind. And the statement doesn't say that, despite the way some people have tried to parse it. The fact that something is potentially a danger to the gospel doesn't mean we have to separate over it right now. Let's talk about it. Let's sort some of these issues out, and there needs to be a conversation. And what I think was illustrated in the Q&A at the Shepherd's Conference is how difficult it's going to be to have that conversation. And, you know, the appeal for clarity. You said we need to clarify some things. Not only what are we saying, but what do we think about this? I think there are men in important positions of influence who haven't carefully thought this through yet, or maybe they have, and they're being deliberately ambiguous, but there's a lot of ambiguity surrounding this that until it's absolutely clear, or until it's clear that, you know, that men whom we have previously trusted are now prepared to compromise the gospel. I'm not ready to make that judgment. Some are.
Let me just ask a couple of follow-up questions on that. How much, if at all, do you think people's perception of the Dallas statement, because typically when we hear about a statement, the Nashville statement, the ECT statement, the Chicago statement on the Bible, you know, those were perceived as, look, if you got this wrong, you're outside of orthodoxy. People, I think, at least some, had that perception of it. Do you believe that that contributed to the confusion that we're seeing today with what, even the fact that at Shepherd's Conference, there were people on different sides of the issue sharing a platform? Did the statement itself, do you think, contribute to the confusion?
I don't know. I don't see those statements that way. With the possible exception of the Chicago statement on biblical inerrancy, I didn't see any of those statements as, or at least the effort to make those statements was not intended to make the sort of line in the sand where you sign this or I won't have anything to do with you, or if you sign this, I won't have anything to do with you. In some cases, it worked out that way over time, but I don't think the intention of any of those statements was to say, all right, here's the dividing line, and you either line up with us or we renounce fellowship with you. And in practice, that hasn't happened with any of those statements. With arguably the one that stands out as different is the Chicago statement on biblical inerrancy. And that statement was the culmination of a very long discussion about biblical inerrancy. That was a sort of different and unique kind of issue, the way that was dealt with.
All right. So right now, it seems that we are still, we're only about a year into this whole thing, which has really been new to the evangelical dialogue. We're a year into a conversation about social justice. It doesn't seem, Phil, that we have really any more clarity on individual stands from the people with whom we have shared platforms and done ministry together. Do you think we have any more clarity today than we did a year ago?
Some, yeah, I do. I do. Okay. I think it's more clear, maybe not the issues themselves, but you know, how passionately people feel about on one side or the other of this. There is still a ton of, there's more ambiguity than there is clarity, but I do think some things have been clarified, yeah.
All right, how long, if you had to guess, how long is it going to take do you think this whole thing kind of settles out and we know where everybody stands on the wide spectrum of beliefs on social justice?
I'm not very good at predicting that. And I think
you need to start going to Bethel then. You'd get very, very good at this.
Yeah. I would say my inclination is to say about 5 years or less. I think I'm willing to give it a few years. I've said this before. I think the whole social justice debate is actually a subset and a remnant of the emerging church movement. They were talking about social justice as well. And that movement melted down and fell apart because there were so many other issues that they agreed or disagreed on and whatever. I predicted that movement wouldn't last longer than 15 years, and I think it lasted actually only about 6 or 7 from the time Christianity Today wrote about it until the movement really dissolved on itself was about 7 years. So half the time that I predicted on that one, because not everybody who was using that language, we're emerging, we're emergent, whatever they wanted to say, they weren't all saying the same things, and they didn't agree with each other. And so it never became a coherent movement. And the people on the extremes ruined it for anybody who had any kind of conservative notion who wanted to be part of that. And I was glad the whole thing melted down, because I thought even the most conservative people in the emerging movement were headed in a bad direction. I think there's something similar here, and this is a subset of some of the arguments that Emergent was making, that we need to adapt, you know, what we're doing as a church and the gospel message, and it's a bigger, more full-orbed thing than just the doctrine of salvation, forgiveness of sin, atonement, and all of that, that there are bigger issues, and there are social issues, and the church needs to get involved and speak out on these things, and that becomes then the focus. And in a similar way, you've got some fairly conservative people who would identify themselves as positive about social justice, and then you have the whacked out extreme who are the vocal ones who are going to ruin the movement for everybody else. And I think there's going to come a time when those guys who have any kind of conservative instinct and any genuine commitment to a biblical understanding of the gospel are going to have to separate themselves from the rest of the movement, because they're not going to be able to follow the social justice movement into the social gospel, and that's where it's headed. It's becoming liberation theology and all the whole package of liberalism.
Okay, that leads us to potentially understanding the broad spectrum of issues in the social justice movement. I think from the very beginning, Phil, most of us have been focusing on words. We're hearing these new words, critical race theory, intersectionality, identity politics, new to the evangelical conversation, and we've tried to focus on those words. We've heard cultural Marxism being used.
Not by me, by the way. I think the accusation of cultural Marxism is one that I have not made, and I think needs to be made sparingly. I don't think most of the evangelicals who are talking about social justice are consciously and deliberately Marxists.
No, I don't think anybody has been doing that. It's just that I think people have tried to make the case that these, what they're saying, it sounds an awful lot like it.
Yeah.
Now, all of those different things, let's just say it's critical race theory, it's systemic racism, it's identity politics, it's intersectionality, it's Gramscian Marxism. If somebody disagrees with me on those words, the definitions, and what they represent, are they heretics?
No, and that's where I think, you know, you have to really apply what the Apostle Paul said to Timothy when he said, don't get involved in silly disputes over words. This is not a debate about words. It's a question about where the church is headed with the gospel message. What are we commissioned and called by Christ to do? And where do these social justice issues fit in? And honestly, I think it's important to say this is not primarily about, and not ultimately going to be about, you know, ethnic relationships and racism and that. It is about intersectionality. It is about the whole range of victimhood. And what I see this as is a Trojan horse into which is going to be smuggled into the church sympathy for, first of all, same-sex relationships, and then homosexuality, and the full package of liberal social issues. These are all connected in the dialogue about social justice as it's happening out there in the secular world. And for evangelicals to borrow those issues, to borrow even the language, and therefore open the door for those issues to become matters of discussion and debate among evangelicals, it's a dangerous trend. And you see it already happening. I think a lot of the focus has shifted from ethnic relationships already to where the matters that are being debated are same-sex attraction, same-sex relationships, and ultimately homosexuality and even gay marriage.
Okay, but I'm gonna try to stick with what these words represent. I got totally what you're saying. You fear this is where it's heading, but for the sake of understanding who's who, if somebody has a different position on those aforementioned words, On the face of it, they're not heretics.
Let's just say that doesn't prove they're heretics. They may be. And
sure.
a lot of people,
okay. Yeah, fair enough. Okay.
A lot of people who use those terms and think that they this really needs to be part of the evangelical discussion. We need to embrace the idea of intersectionality and talk about it in our churches and all that. Some of the people who are touting that are heretics. Let's be clear about that. But it doesn't mean that everybody who is sympathetic to that kind of dialogue. There are a lot of, you know, Christians who are not, I was going to say foolish. And there is some foolishness in it where Christians watch what goes on. We've educated evangelicals for 50 years or longer to watch what's going on in the culture and try as much as possible to adopt the language and arguments mm-hmm. and issues and entertainment and everything from
Trends.
The world into the church. And not everybody who's doing that is a conscious, deliberate, Christ-denying heretic. But good people do foolish things sometimes, and that needs to be opposed, even if it's being done by people who are our friends.
All right. So those, well stated, those issues, not necessarily heretical, but you brought up the issue of the gospel, and that if the gospel gets expanded to, it must include social justice or social justice activities. Then would you say that is the line where we would have to definitely part company?
I think that's too big of a category. I would say, you know, to what degree are you talking about? I don't like the language social justice. I'm one of those who said, you know, justice in Scripture doesn't need to be modified by any adjective. And once you start talking about social justice, usually the idea is not, this is my duty for my neighbor. Social justice then becomes a lobbying for the government to do acts of charity on our behalf, usually by, you know, taxing someone else. And it's not really justice at all. So that would be my complaint even about the term social justice. It's such a broad category. When someone uses it, you really don't necessarily know everything they intend. But since the terminology itself has a questionable heritage, it's something that definitely raises my antenna and makes me think, wait a minute, I don't think we agree on this.
Okay, then let me put it like this.
Okay.
You and I would say that the born-again Christian has the gospel is that sinners are saved by grace alone, through faith alone, in Jesus Christ alone, period. Because of that, we go about the business of doing good deeds, becoming more sanctified, and caring about issues of justice. What a different group of folks seem to be hinting, but I've never heard any clarity, is that those deeds must be included in the gospel. Somehow, I've never heard anybody articulate it yet, but somehow, doing deeds of justice, caring about reconciliation issues, if it is not a part of the gospel, it's no gospel at all.
Right.
Wouldn't we say that is where we would then draw the line when it comes to fellowship?
Would I automatically break fellowship with somebody because he says that? I don't know. I mean, let's name an example. Paul Tripp, in the week after the MLK 50 conference last year, posted a tweet that said something like, I've just realized that although I thought I always understood the gospel, I never really thoroughly I'm paraphrasing him. I don't remember his exact language. But he said, I've held to a truncated gospel, and I've just seen by being woke, I've realized the full-orbed gospel. A statement like that just sends shivers down my spine. I think this is not, he's not thinking clearly about the gospel. What he's saying is actually dangerous because he's blending something else with the gospel, which is exactly what Paul condemns throughout his epistles. Would I sever fellowship with him? Would I declare him a heretic on the basis of a single tweet like that? No. But it definitely raises the antenna where I say, I do not agree with this, and I wouldn't invite him to, you know, come and teach my Sunday school class.
Without getting some sort of clarification, by the way, as an aside, I'm about three quarters of the way through Instruments in the Redeemer's Hands by Paul Tripp. It's a really excellent book. It's just really, really helpful.
Yeah. No, he's said and written some excellent things. I've spoken at conferences with him. So he's not someone I'm prepared to consign to the ranks of heresy, but a statement like that definitely raises my concerns. And that's just in microcosm, that illustrates what concerns me about the current evangelical push for social justice issues, particularly by organizations like the Gospel Coalition and Together for the Gospel, organizations that were founded to defend our common understanding of the gospel of redemption, and now they're talking about bigger issues as if they're part of the gospel. There just desperately needs to be some clarity brought to what are they saying? What do they mean by this?
You see, that's the word again right there. So, all right, I'm trying to draw some lines here that will just help us navigate a bit. I meet a brother who says that they believe in some of these words, the aforementioned words that we've discussed. Okay, and we can break bread together. Somebody who says, I believe social justice needs to be a part of the gospel. At the very least, that's when I start asking a lot of questions to get definition of what they mean by that. Because
right.
if they mean you somehow have to be doing works in order to be saved, obviously that would be the line. So let's debate these words that we've been talking about. But when it comes to the gospel, we're going to get really finicky, and that's the territory that could indeed cause separation. Is that a fair summary of where we're at, perhaps?
It is, and I think those who suddenly are talking a lot about social justice, this is the center of their message now, the duty falls on them, especially men who have historically affirmed the gospel. They were part of the movement that was sort of coalesced to defend the gospel against the emerging trends back 10 years ago or so. It is their duty, I think, to explain how what they're saying now differs from the similar rhetoric that we've always heard from liberation theology and social gospel people. It's retreads of old arguments that were used to undermine the gospel. And those who are concerned about it have a legitimate reason for being concerned. It's not that we're just trying to be contrary here. It's that historically, this kind of rhetoric and this kind of language has always undermined the clarity of the gospel. And so when you've got men using that sort of language and they are reluctant to clarify what they mean, it's disturbing, and it there's no way it's not going to raise concerns from people who actually know their history and truly have a commitment to the simplicity of the gospel. And so, yeah, I think it's a discussion that needs to take place, and obfuscating on the side of those who are touting social justice is only going to make things more tense and more difficult.
Well, how many times, Phil, if you recall from the MLK 50, if you had to guess how many times somebody on the platform said, this is a gospel issue,
right.
A dozen or two times, over and over again. So here's what I think could bring some clarity. I'd have no expectation of this, but here's my proposal. Everybody who was uncomfortable for any reason in signing the Dallas Statement, okay, you've got an issue with this or that. You've got some consideration behind the scenes. Understood. For the sake of clarity, then, why don't y'all put together a statement on where you stand, focusing on these issues, but especially a definition of the gospel and its relationship to what we'll just call, for lack of a better term, social justice. Y'all create a statement. Wouldn't that help a ton, Phil?
It would. When the Dallas Statement was published, someone asked Al Mohler in one of his Ask Anything sessions what he thought of it, and he gave a vague critique of it. He said he'd read it, and he didn't think it was the most helpful thing, and he wouldn't sign it because he just didn't agree with certain things the way it said it. He thought it wasn't worded the best. Again, it was vague what he said, but then he said the good thing about it is it will generate a discussion that needs to take place. And I agree with that. It doesn't bother me if someone didn't sign it because they can't agree with all the language on it. But let's talk about it. Let's talk about it openly. I think one of the things the Q&A at the Shepherd's Conference reflected is that this is not a discussion that some of the principal people want to have publicly. And so, all right, let's have it privately.
You know, and I'd even be fine, then have the conversations privately, but then articulate positions and statements and let everybody know. You know, the devil loves confusion, and it seems that that is the hallmark of this whole thing, is absolute and utter confusion. I just wish, look, if you don't want somebody like, I don't know, Phil Johnson asking particular questions, okay, but then why don't you take your time privately, figure them out, answer them, and let everybody know so that we're not in the dark anymore. I just think, I don't know how that could possibly be a bad thing to bring the truth into the light, whatever it happens to be. So now let us get back, Phil, to the Q&A that happened at the Shepherd's Conference.
I was hoping we wouldn't have to come back to that.
Well,
that was not my happiest hour.
Well, let's talk about that. Many people saw the Q&A, but now there's a lot of people who are saying there's their opinions or their critique of it. And some of them, you can tell us if they have been valid or invalid. Starting with you, Phil Johnson, sabotaged everybody. Nobody knew this issue was going to be discussed. You zinged it on them, and that's where the train went off the track. True?
Yeah, I am eager to clarify that misperception. I didn't just blindside everybody with that. We had had at least two discussions for 2 days in a row prior to the Q&A with the men in the green room, in which I said, I'm going to raise these questions. And I said, I'm not looking for... I don't want animosity or tension or a big argument, but I also don't want us to pretend that we're all on the same page on this, because we really aren't. What I want is for us to clarify where we stand on this. And as it turned out, I don't think necessarily that was accomplished, but they did know ahead of time.
There was a bit, Phil. There was a bit. I mean, you had to kind of, you know, shake it like you were mining for gold, but there was some there that I thought was helpful. In fact, I thought some of it was quite positive.
Right. But what I just wanted to make clear is I didn't try to sucker punch those guys. I had, as far as I could, informed them ahead of time that I was going to raise that subject. I didn't want it to be the only focus of the Q&A. I had told them, look, I'm going to start with some softball questions and end with some, you know, forward-looking positive questions, and we'll put the social justice issue in the middle so that it doesn't, you know, end on a sour note. And but I didn't tell them what questions I was going to ask except for the social justice questions. I said, look, I'm going to ask generic questions. I don't want to name people who you are affiliated with and get into personalities and stuff, but I'll ask general questions like, how far apart are we on this? You know, precisely where do you disagree with the Dallas statement and all that? But when the questions came up like that in the Q&A, it was like they didn't understand the question. So in a way, I felt a little bit sucker punched, but... Anyway, and also I should say that Al Mohler might have a legitimate reason to think that I didn't properly prepare him, because he wasn't in the green room before the Q&A. So he missed, I think, the lengthy discussions that we had prior to the Q&A about what we were going to talk about.
So there was no blindsiding going on. Phil, you did this because there's animosity and there's hatred amongst the men on that platform. True or false?
Well, yeah, no, the opposite is true. Those are all men that I love and have benefited from, and I would hate to see a division occurring. But we do disagree on this issue, and you know, ultimately we're going to have to talk about it.
All right. Here's an observation that people have been making, that John MacArthur was trying to be a peacemaker in the situation and kind of move the subject along. True or false?
Yeah, well, he's always a peacemaker. That's what people don't necessarily recognize about John. He hates conflict.
That does shock right there. That does shock. Because if anybody has ever been bold about, here's the position, It's John MacArthur, but you're telling us he doesn't like controversy.
No,
or when confrontation.
When he's preaching, he only wants to proclaim and defend the truth. So people think of him as a controversialist because he's non-compromising as a preacher. In personal face-to-face interaction, he is the most gracious man you'll ever meet, sometimes almost to a fault. You know, if someone needs to be rebuked or fired or demoted on our staff, you don't let John do it. He'll end up giving him a promotion. Which I love about him, that he's so kind-hearted, you know, and he absolutely hates conflict, personal conflict in particular. And so that brings a great balance, I think, to how he preaches and what he does in the pulpit. He's fearless and bold and just takes a stand for the truth. But, you know, in private face-to-face encounters, he is just supremely gracious.
Okay, who was the guy who introduced him and said, they were at a conference or whatever it was, hey, I met John MacArthur, and I got to tell you something. You know, he's really nice. He's nothing like the way he is in the pulpit. You remember that?
Yep. And
who was that said that? Do you recall?
I don't remember. I think I've only heard John tell the story of that, but don't think I was there when it happened. But
all right. So John was being gracious during the count. What about afterwards? Was there a to the mattresses sort of conversation that happened? How did it resolve itself after the fact?
Yeah, not really. Right after the thing, we had a meeting on a different issue, and so we didn't actually talk about it for a while. But he said to me afterwards, boy, I've never seen you that persistent. And I said, really? Because that's who I am. So, you know, obviously, if he had had his preferences, I don't think he would have wanted that Q&A to be, confrontational. And I wasn't trying to make it confrontational. It became that way, and I'm sorry about that. In fact, I wrote an email to Dr. Moeller and apologized for pressing him with questions after it was obvious he didn't really want to go down that road. Particularly since he wasn't in those lengthy green room discussions where we talked about where we were going to go with this. I think maybe this situation wasn't entirely fair to him. So,
all right. Are there any other rumors, gossip, insinuations that have been made that you would like to address right now?
Not that I can think of. I've been intrigued by some of the autopsies that have been done on the Q&A. I thought Doug Wilson did one on Cross Politic, their podcast, which I thought he had some very sage observations. I was very interested. I didn't agree with everything Doug said, but I thought in general, overall, he had a pretty good take on the thing. So did you, and so did James White. So, yeah, I think people have been generally fair with it. One other thing that I would like to correct, and there's a lot of speculation on why that video isn't on the Grace Church website. It was streamed live video on Facebook, but those live streams are always taken down after a couple of days. So that's just general policy, because then high quality videos are edited and put back online. That was technically kind of a breakout session. It wasn't one of the plenary sessions. All the plenary sessions videos are going to be online. If you want the Q&A, I believe the audio is up, but I doubt that they'll put the video up. I don't think there's any particular reason to do that. But nobody's trying to cover up what happened.
And you know what? Phil, you tell me if you agree with this. Yeah, because I heard people asking that too. And, you know, was there any explanation for the video not being up? And I thought, well, yeah, there's lots of explanations for it. I mean, there could be many, many things. But I stop and I go, I really don't need to seek an answer. This is a tried and true and tested ministry. And if they choose to pull it down for whatever reason, something like that, I would just look at it and go, whatever, and not come up with some sort of conspiracy to surround it. The video itself, if we were doing a conference at Wretched and one of our speakers after, whether it was a Q&A or even preaching, said, you know, I wasn't happy with this for this reason, even if I disagreed with that reason, Phil, I would honor the guest and go, no problem, we won't post it. I mean, that's just manners.
I'll tell you, my preference would be any session I'm in, just put the audio up. I don't need to see video of myself.
Well, that's
I hate that.
You know what? You just need to work through that with your therapist. But what I'm saying is that people, you know, just if they requested from us, please don't. This has happened to us many times. We've interviewed people. And Phil, I'm telling you, there was, I'm thinking of one, and Joey could even chime in because he's probably going to know. When I one day was actually invited in to the office of the dean of a seminary who basically revealed he doesn't even believe Jesus Christ is God. Nothing. And it was all recorded. And he said, oh, please, don't air that or I will be fired, which, frankly, I thought he should. Nevertheless, it pained me, but we honored that. And yeah. And so I look at Grace to You. I don't know who maybe even asked, if anybody did at all, but that would be an explanation.
Yeah.
Somebody asked and you just accommodated.
Now, I should make a couple of things clear. Grace to You doesn't sponsor the Shepherd's Conference. That's Grace Church. It's a different organization, different media group. They have their own video people who do that. So here at Grace to You, we have no control over what they post and what they don't post. But I have a scoop for you. While we're talking about this, I got a text saying that they're still working on editing those Shepherd's Conference videos, and that Q&A video will be posted.
Well, there you have it, right? Breaking news right here from Phil Johnson of Grace to You, which is not Grace Church, because we just heard there's a big difference between the two.
Yeah.
All right. Phil, there is just one thing where I would like to take issue with you, and I think this might be the most important thing in this entire rather lengthy. We're becoming James White here, Phil. We're becoming James White with the length of this Too Wretched for Radio.
I know, but it's worth it. I love it when you disagree with me.
Well, here's my big disagreement, and it's a pretty big one. You had said the emergent movement fell apart under its own weight. It couldn't sustain it. Disagreements. I just totally disagree. I think the emergent movement fell apart because of Brian McLaren's singing.
Oh, no.
Follow the poor man from the poor part of town with lepers and beggars.
You know, I'd almost rather hear Baby Shark.
This is the ending of the program, Phil.
With a little